Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, and welcome to our Q&A satsang for this week. I'm really happy to see so many of you here. And there's a couple of questions that have shown up already. But before we start, I would like to read you the commentary on this sutra that my guru wrote, and which was my first contact with it. It's from a book called Nothing Exists That Is Not Shiva, and it's where the quote from last week also is also from. Nothing Exists That Is Not Shiva is a collection of writings that Swami Muktananda did on different texts of Kashmir Shaivism. They are not scholarly in the usual sense, but what they are is profoundly powerful in an intuitive way because of the state that he brought to everything that he taught and spoke. Because he was very, very, very close to this text. And as I think I said in the first class, he read this, the Pratibhigna Hridayam, I believe in a Hindi translation, after he had become enlightened, self-realized. So he loved this text because it actually explained his experience of reality, and especially the experience of reality that the way one experiences reality after enlightenment, after self-realization. So this is Swami Muktananda on Sutra 5 of the Pratyabhijna Hridayam. Remember the words, Chitti herself, this is his, this is one translation. It's not exactly, well, it's pretty much like the one we used. Chitti herself, descending from the plane of pure consciousness, Chaitanya, becomes the mind by contracting in accordance with the object perceived. So he says, this aphorism is the very lifeblood of sadhana, of spiritual practice. It is priceless. If a seeker could understand this aphorism alone and believe in its truth, meditation would come to him by itself, and so would knowledge. Chitti descends from her true condition, from pure consciousness, assumes the form of object she perceives, contracts herself, and becomes the mind. It is essential to know the truth about the mind. The mind is full of chitti. If you don't understand this, you will not be able to steady the mind, no matter how much you try. Often an aspirant looks for answers in books and toils interminably to control his mind. He exhausts himself in his attempts at suppression, does that sound familiar, only to find that he is as far away from controlling the mind as he was when he started. Every day his mind grows in restlessness and turbulence. He falls into a despair so black that he renounces the spiritual path, convinced that the mind is impossible to subdue. In this despair, he dissipates all that he has gained through yoga. A yogi should ponder the nature of this mind he is trying to stabilize. What exactly is it? Of what substance is it made? How does it come into existence? How can it be overcome? It is essential to grapple with these questions. Awareness of the mind's nature is the root of yoga, meditation, and all spiritual disciplines. Meditation will not be far from one who has acquired true knowledge of the mind. An equal vision will quickly follow. So that's Swami Muktananda's commentary on the sutra we've been working with. And I'm just going to throw the call open to any questions. We'll start with Deb, anything that's come in on the webcast. We'll start with that and then with live questions, and they don't have to be about the sutra or about what I've just read, though, of course, we're delighted to discuss that.
And you'll just need to hit star 2 to raise your hand. And our first question comes from Laurel She's asking any suggestions on how to create an entirely new world as Shakti creates through us. I know our responsiveness and creativity matter greatly. I see, discern subtle beauty in small changes and wonder into how to conjure a vast, expansive transformation for the highest, deepest good.
Oh, that is a great question and and a big one. My first instinct on hearing what you asked is that, you know, that political aphorism that has, the political sutra that has been popular for the last 10 or 15 years, which is think globally, act locally, because this is really what this sadhana asks of us, that is to have the intention to look at the big picture, that is to be intending to recognize chitti shakti as the basis of everything you experience. And then with that recognition, then you do the practice that is called for at a given moment. And the idea is that you are, at the very least, creating in your internal field, your internal world, a predisposition to be shown by chitti shakti what you really are and what the world really is. So it always starts with you, which is, of course, one of the major truths of spiritual life. We cannot at one stroke change the way the world is because we're not in charge of how the world is. She's in charge of it, and she's manifesting as all the parts of it. But what we can do is work with our own mind, our own creative instincts, our own intuition, and begin to allow chitti shakti to shift the fundamental attitudes with which we're engaging ourselves and our relationships and understanding the world around us. And that is going to create a field from which you interact in a, you know, essentially an enlightened way. And it's going to affect everything around you. So it's always about starting with your attitude towards your own mind, your own emotions, and, of course, your own practice. So thank you for that question, and may our practice really start changing the world one psyche at a time.
Okay, and we now have someone in Oregon. If you raised your hand, go ahead and speak up.
Can you hear me?
Now.
Can
you? Yes. There you go.
Yes.
Okay, thank you. My name is Wolf.
Hi,
and
Wolf.
I have a big question. And for me it's a big question. Yeah. I think I should say a few things about me, which is that I, for a long time, am an adept of the Great Mother.
Mm.
I started with Mary, the Mother of God, in my mysterious Catholic origination, and then later to Kuan Yin, and finally to Tara. And my house is full of statues and full of books, and Rian Eisler was an enlightened understanding why the Mother Goddess was kind of banned by the invasion of all these warlike tribes into the peaceful mother territory. And so they came with a father god who wanted war, and the same thing happened in India too. Sanskrit came from the warlike tribes that came with it, more chariots. So now on this mysterious and this wonderful day, December 14, I heard you, Sally, on a YouTube, and you talked about Bhubaneshwari and all of a sudden I was disappearing into her universe, and that's why I'm participating here.
It's so beautiful.
And so she is the creatress, I mean, the goddess, a great goddess in all her forms, and she, all particles in our body are her. And then I read the quote of Muktananda that you gave last time, the last Q&A. You know, it's actually Shiva is us, and Shiva is the world, and Shiva is this. And my big question is, why do we need a male god? Why do we need Shiva? Why do so that's my question.
Yes. Great question. And I think the thing that is at the heart of this teaching is, I mean, first of all, obviously, at the level that the text and that Muktananda is speaking of, Shiva is not gendered. So in Tantra, Shiva, Shakti are one. So, you know, like the yin yang symbol, which is actually a universal understanding in the truly non-dual traditions. When we understand, and especially when we experience the transcendent reality, we recognize that it is both still and dynamic, and that its stillness, its quality as transcendent light, which is really how Shiva is described, is what we call the Shiva aspect, or we could say the divine masculine aspect, and the dynamic creative energy within that is the Shakti aspect, is the mother aspect. And in Tantra, the understanding is that the Shiva, the light, the divine masculine, is the ground of everything, you know, that we talk in a lot of traditions about the ground of being. The underlying witnessing light that holds it all. And that Shakti is the aspect of that light that becomes a manifest world. So Bhuvaneshwari, for example, who is also one of my most favorite forms of the Divine Mother, represents the complete creative fullness of the Shakti aspect of the Absolute, of the creative aspect of the Absolute, who, if you remember the Tattva conversation, gradually condenses herself into all the forms of this world. So we don't need a divine masculine. I mean, we can call God masculine or feminine. And, you know, even though mostly people have called God masculine, there is a strong tradition that calls God goddess, just not so much in Europe and the Western world. But the truth is that ultimately this isness, which is at the heart of everything, is neither masculine nor feminine. Masculine and feminine come in a little later. And my orientation and the orientation of people who consider reality feminine is that both masculine deities and feminine deities are ways in which this primordial Shakti expresses herself as she begins to manifest worlds. So, in other words, Shakti manifests, let's call them ruling forces, individualized beings who are what we call deities. And it's a kind of a radical idea for the West, but and again, we discussed it a bit in the Tattva's conversation. But my understanding is, and my experience is, that all the gods, you know, I mean, we're talking like including Allah, Jehovah, you know, God, that being that we call God in the West, are actually they arise at a more condensed stage of the journey. So we, in a certain sense, we need Shiva because the world is going to go on to become a binary world, right, in which reproduction mostly happens through, some sort of merging of two poles of reality, which we call masculine feminine. And that, that quality, that binary quality is, is all through the universe. It's through, certainly through the living beings in the universe. I have outside my window a eucalyptus tree, which is a masculine eucalyptus tree. It looks quite different from the trees in front of my house, which are supposedly, they're called feminine. And I think that this has something to do with the way they reproduce. I don't know enough about eucalyptus trees to be able to say that with certainty. But in other words, gender difference happens at a slightly lower level than the ultimate level. But gender difference is part of the way she makes this. She made this. And my guru came from a family and a culture which described God as Shiva. That was his orientation. That was how he was brought up. And even though his own experience and his writing is deeply worshipful of the divine feminine, when he talks in the most intimate way about God, his concept of God, basically he calls God Shiva. So that's why he uses those words. It's not that he believes that Shiva is that masculine deity. In fact, when I first met him, and he would give us the mantra Om Namah Shivaya, which was the mantra that he gave, he always said Shiva is not that yogi with the snakes around his neck. Shiva is consciousness itself, whose nature is also Shakti. So does that kind of answer your question?
Yes, and no. I'm deeply familiar with the yin yang, and I know there's two polarities,
right.
and so these are not new. I'm just talking about the top position here. I question. I said, "Oh my God, I'm at a male dominant god again here. The top here is Paramashiva. Why not Paramashakti? I understand now that where your guru and maybe my guru in the future comes from a tradition where God was called Shiva, and I can accept that. It's not a problem. I just wanted to make sure that I don't end up,
Right, in some kind of patriarchal religious tradition.
Yeah, I've been there a lot. I've been there a lot.
I definitely get it.
And I listened today to your tape about the goddesses, and I listened to Bhuvaneshwari, and I was in tears. And I know I'm at the right place. So, and I want to thank you for getting me here.
Well, I want to thank you for being here, and I can feel your devotion, actually, and it's very beautiful. So no, this is not old style patriarchal religion. It's more like I am comfortable talking about God as Shakti and talking about God as Shiva, and that there's something about being fluid with the names. That helps us get past our dualistic understanding. Do you know what I mean? So
yes.
Yeah. So
I'm with
so
you.
Thank you.
Okay, I think we have a follow-up question from Laurel. She's wondering. She meant a huge change in her own world rather than just a subtle shift.
Oh, okay. You mean change her whole way of thinking, doing, acting?
Yeah.
You know, it's a really good question, and it's everybody's question.
Okay.
So my own experience and what the tradition says is that you hold this perspective that your consciousness is not different than the consciousness that has created everything, and that by bringing yourself again and again and again to that recognition, you are gradually drawn to a fully empowered experience of your own consciousness. And at that point, and again, this is the yoga tradition talking, at that point, your consciousness becomes capable of manifesting vast transformations in your inner experience, subtle changes, and also changes that are very palpable and affect the exterior world. But this is something that there are a number of ways of approaching that place, one of which is to make a huge effort to transform the exterior, without starting with the interior. And the second method, which is more what we're talking about, is to really give attention to transforming the interior. And then what starts to happen is that the external world reshapes itself in a kind of a natural way. So the people around you, the world you're seeing, it starts to reveal itself more and more as sacred, as alive, as connected, and and at that point, especially, and it takes and should take a lot of inner practice, a lot of inner work, because in order for it to be a good idea to create a new world, you really have to have cooked your the tendency of the ahamkara, the ego, to identify yourself with personal doership. So what the tantras tell us is you keep walking the path, you keep doing it, what you're doing, and gradually Shakti empowers your senses, your words, your actions, and transformation starts to happen through you and around you. The world starts to look different. I can tell you this from my own experience, that the world will start to reveal itself as the playground of exquisite, blissful, transformative particles of Shakti. But at least as far as I've ever experienced, we don't make this happen. She makes it happen. She does it. And we, as Jack Kornfield famously said, enlightenment is an accident, but we can make ourselves accident prone. Tantra doesn't see it that way. Tantra sees that as we practice, our capacities grow, our power grows. But really, the power that's growing is her power. And part of our job, even as we become more skilled at the arts and and skills that we pursue in our life, nonetheless, it's really important to realize that we can't make that happen. We can't make the world transform itself into the playground of Chitti, but she can, and she is, and she's doing that through you, through your eyes, through your heart, through your art, through your words, and it's becoming more and more transformed with every passing month. So basically what I'm telling you is really stay with the discernment that you have been uncovering and let it grow. And your intention will manifest, but not necessarily in the way that you think it should. It will nonetheless manifest. So, Laurel, I hope that was your question.
Okay. Our next question comes from Dory. She says, in the commentary you read tonight by Mukundatha, he emphatically states how important it is to understand the mind. How do we do that? Are these studies what he's talking about?
Yes. 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 What he means when we say understanding the mind, and as we've been seeing, and as many of you who have studied the mind, you know, whether as psychologists, as yogis, as students of yogic or Buddhist or yogic and Buddhist wisdom about the mind, there are many, many levels on which the mind exists. And for instance, contemporary psychology has mapped the mind, or mapped the inner world in particular ways that are useful under particular circumstances. The yogic texts, both of classical yoga and Buddhism, talk about the qualities in the instruments in the mind, the buddhi, the ahamkara, the manas, the different ways in which the powers in the mind operate, which is very interesting to understand. But what the Pratyabhijna Hridayam and what Muktananda is saying is that, and what we're doing in this, especially this week in the practice, in the homework, for instance, is learning how to look at our own mind, at the energetic substratum of our own thinking mind, to see through the content, which, most of us are completely nailed to. We're all about believing in what is happening in our perceptual process, this what the mind is telling us, to begin to start to look into what thoughts are made of and what our perceptions are really made of, with the understanding that at the root of everything we experience is this very subtle substance that is chitti shakti, that's always moving and changing. So when he says understand what the mind is, what he's really saying ultimately is that rather than, he's talking to meditators essentially. He's talking about one of the huge problems that we encounter in spiritual practice, which is the fact that essentially thinking won't stop, that there's this seemingly endless mental dialogue and emotional dialogue that try as we will, we don't seem to have control over. He's essentially saying that rather than trying to control it, if you understand that chitti shakti, that the creative power of the universe, is manifesting as the substance of every single thought or perception that arises for you, if you start to remember that it's all chitti shakti, you will, in a fairly short time, have a very different relationship to your own mind. You won't have to believe every single negative thought the mind throws up. You'll be able to discern whether the information that's coming to you through your thought stream is worth paying attention to. You'll be able, in other words, to use the mental apparatus as a servant rather than being mastered by it. So yes, that's what this work is all about. That's really at the heart of what we're doing in this class, is learning to understand our own mind, not just understand it intellectually, although, that is quite a bit of what we're doing, but to understand it by working with some of the practices that are in the homework, and the practices that you in your creativity will start to be inspired to use as ways of actually turning your attention backward so that you can examine what a thought is, what happens when a thought arises in your inner field, what happens when a thought dissolves, and you start at a certain point to recognize that there's this absolute flow of energy that is manifesting as your mind, and that is the filter that we normally that normally allows us to experience everything, but which also keeps us perceiving as if through a veil, because we're so we have such a tendency to believe what the mind tells us, and to believe that what we're perceiving, what we're experiencing as the room we're in or as the person we're talking to is fixed and absolute, rather than being able to see everything that we experience as flowing energy, which is what it really is. So that's what this work is meant to do. It's meant to kind of deconstruct your tendency to see the mind in a fixed way and to see thoughts and perceptions in a fixed way. And one of the interventions which Shema Raja recommends and which many, many spiritual traditions recommend is to stay present to the capacity for awareness that is actually always present even when you're very stuck in thinking, so that you can simultaneously feel the flow of energy as your thoughts and emotions and perceptions, and also begin to be more and more familiar with the background awareness, which is the chetana, the pure consciousness part of the mind. So by being willing to hold the connection to awareness or pure consciousness or that power to self-reflect, and at the same time to start to realize that whatever is going on in your mind is rising and falling, it's coming and going, none of it is fixed. So that's when you're starting to understand the mind. And this takes a while to grasp, but what I would say to you is notice what happens to your self experience, toward your feeling in this moment when you think, okay, my mind, meaning my thoughts processes, my emotional processes, is actually made out of chitti shakti. It's not fixed. It's not hard. It's not different than goddess. And just notice what happens to your inner world when you're holding that understanding, even provisionally, and when your interest is in discovering what it means to say that every thought is consciousness, that the mind is made of creative consciousness. That investigation is the heart of what we're doing here. So thank you for the question. It's a great question.
Okay, we've got someone in Oregon that's raised their hand. Another person.
Hi. Hi, it's Wendy. Hi, Sally.
Hi, Wendy.
Anyway, deep bows of gratitude. This is been a really remarkable experience, and yet one that I a lot of times feel like I can't even really grok. Like when you're talking and doing the class, even when I listen to it multiple times, like I just can't stay with it. I just get into that deep sleep meditation, not sleeping, but it's amazing how overpowering, or I can't mentally do it in some strange ways, you know, but it's like still really infusing my meditation space in a way that I can't remember maybe since we did the Spandarkarika class, but it feels different even from that. So that's weird because there's a lot of ways that I feel like especially when I follow all of the chains on the emails, like I just feel like a novice, that I'm just trying to keep up. And yet it's also really beyond thought what's happening for me. So I'm just reporting that and grateful for just being here and participating, just watching and witnessing. But I actually have been thinking about this for a long time, and I don't know if it's something that you feel like you can discuss. Two questions. One is kind of straightforward and simple, but when you gave the instruction about following the end of the mantra to like where it stops and that space that it falls into, because actually there was a question last week about the person who asked about how the mantra and the breath, and he stopped breathing. And there's
right.
that whole teaching that you give so many times about the space at the end of the breath and
right.
the beginning of the breath. And so to me, that feels the same. And I'm just wondering, is that very similar? Is that the same space that opens to the divine, the end of the
yes.
breath and the end of the mantra?
Short answer is yes. So what this text and the Vijnana Bhairava, which is where both of these two meditations actually come from, the Vijnana Bhairava. And if you remember that the space at the end of the breath is called the madhya,
mm-hmm.
which means center. The space at the end of a thought is also called madhya. So these are two, let's say, windows or doorways into the underlying consciousness. The breath arises from chitti shakti. Breath is more energetic. It's a little bit more physical than the, or at least as we experience it, than the mind. But they're both coming out of the same infinitely subtle space, and following the breath to the place where the inhalation and exhalation end is literally following it to the doorway that leads into the source of the breath, which is open, spacious chitti shakti. Similarly, thoughts all arise from that ever-changing open field that manifests the mind. And so if you remember, classical yoga talks, especially in the Hatha yoga tradition, talks about how the breath and the mind are so connected that when the breath stops, the mind stops. And when the mind stops, the breath stops, which is why when we get into a very quiet meditation, we sometimes stop breathing. They're the same space.
So I appreciate that confirmation, because it feels like the same practice when I do it. But the other question is a little bit more complicated, and it's kind of associated to the question that was asked earlier about sort of the monotheistic male gods, which we like had a lot of conversations about during the Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna. And Krishna is actually all the goddesses, and you know, we kind of talked about that. But I remember a really long time ago when I met you at a tantra conference, a yoga tantric conference, and I, one of the things that I became so enamored with when I first heard you teach was the idea of all the stories that you told about, like Bhairava and his Bhairavi, and that the divinity happened in the love between them.
Yeah.
So there's all those different millions of stories that you told. And like even like the goddesses, when they were out of control, it was like the god that held the space for the goddess to be herself. And so it was this really incredible, intimate lovemaking that the male and female, that's how I came to sort of follow you, really, because I that's how I think about God. And And so I just kind of wonder if you could talk about that, because we're living in such a weird time that's so, like, you know, painfully non-sexual because it's just about sexual injury. But
yeah.
It's also, I think, the very source of what we all want. And so, anyway, I know I do a lot of work about sexuality. It's a very hard time to do that, too. But
what I've
learned most from you is that space between the Shakti and the Shiva is where that divine comes up. Is that right?
Yes, that is completely right. And you know, that. So, again, it's because we are in bodies and we're in duality, you know, our experience of that merging, that oneness between the two poles of consciousness, which we call Shiva Shakti or masculine feminine, sexuality is probably the most direct experience that normal human beings have of that potential ecstasy, you know, that comes
right.
from coming together of, you know, of the stillness with the dynamism of the light with the capacity for self-experience. So it's in the space. It's in the space between opposites that
mm-hmm.
unity is found. It's very paradoxical. It's very hard to talk about because our language is so dualistic of its nature, you know. So, but yeah, and you know, one of the reasons why I like to be fluid about the names I worship the divine in, you know, I love to worship Krishna and Shiva and the divine masculine forms as much as I love to worship the divine feminine forms, even though I do feel that we are in a time when it's really important to understand the feminine nature of physical reality, you know, because that's part of how we learn the sacredness of our embodiment. But there's no, both sides of that, you know, both sides of the apparent polarity need to be dignified and held together. So, you know, so that both the dynamism and the stillness, the Shiva quality.
But actually also they don't exist without the other, right? Isn't
they
that
don't exist
thought?
Without the other. Yes, they don't exist without the other.
Yeah.
And, yeah, they literally are their fire and its power to burn, their water and its wetness, they're the sun and its rays. They're,
mm-hmm.
You can't have a sun without having shining. You know, it's you can't have water without wetness. It's
and you can't have all the beautiful action of Shakti if there isn't the space of Shiva to hold it.
Well, exactly. And in our, you know, in our practice, and again, this is a traditional viewpoint, the masculine, the Shiva aspect is the containing, as you were mentioning, the structure, the kind of holding that allows the feminine to be wildly creative. But the Shiva aspect provides a kind of discipline in the creativity. So they just work together. You know, the great tantric statement, which I think you're referring to, Wendy, and that a lot of you know, is that Shiva without Shakti is Shava, which means dead, and Shakti without Shiva is crazy. You know, so they're
mm-hmm.
just they're part of how. They're part of the dynamic interplay of these two aspects of reality, endless
mm-hmm.
creativity and absolute stillness.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, Sally, I just wish I could follow you around because
oh.
no matter how much I study with you, you like know more and more and more. And it's just, it's amazing and it's such a gift. So thank you so much for answering that and just setting my mind at ease. And I just wish we could get over the sexual problems we're having because that's like the Shiva Shakti for every single person.
It totally is, and
mm-hmm.
I just feel that maybe this upheaval is part of what has to happen to equalize things, mm-hmm. you know, so that because it's been so much one way, it, you know,
yeah.
it's going radically another way, and that we're going to come to the recognition that you're talking about.
Yeah.
Know, is,
thank you, Sally. I love you.
I love you too, Wendy. Thank you.
Okay, and now we got another question from our webcast people. She asked, she was just reading the exact quote from Nothing Exists prior
oh,
to
wow.
the call. And she's wondering, what can we do to not get triggered and owned by the mind? In addition to meditation and chanting, how does one contact the true nature of the mind as Baba describes? What is the contemplation? And she says she finds it hard to be aware of awareness.
Right. Yes. And, okay, so there are a number of contemplations, one of which is being aware of awareness. Another one is actually, and you can do it right now, just bring up a thought. We actually did this in the class the other night, but just bring up a thought, and let's say the thought is power, which somehow is feels like it's up right now. So just hold the thought power in your mind. And now take a moment and look at what the thought power is made of in your mind. You know, it's not made of anything material. It's actually a, and, you know, leaving aside questions of language and association and all that, the thought itself, and in fact all the associations with it, if you really look not at the meaning, not at the conceptual aspect of it, but at the substance of it, what it's made of, what you start to see is that thoughts are made of energy. And it's that inquiry, like, okay, what is this thought made of? What is this mood made of? You know, neuroscience will tell us about the neurological pathways that affect the nature, you know, the thoughts that we think and the ways that we feel. What Tantra says is that behind the neurons, behind the brain pathways, behind the biochemical reactions, there is this very, very subtle quality in our capacity for thinking, seeing, hearing, tasting. And the more we start to examine really the sensations or the felt experience of a thought, the more it takes us past the content and into the, I call it the underpinning or the underbelly or the what's underneath the skin of the mind. And that's one of the contemplations that is very powerful, and there's a couple of versions of it in the homework. If you check out the study guide and also some of the contemplations, there are sort of step-by-step instructions about how to do that. So it's really about actually examining in a granular way what is going on in your mind when you're thinking or perceiving. And you can do it in a very open-ended way. So, and eventually as you do, there'll be a kind of aha, and you'll realize that there's absolutely nothing concrete about the mind. It is really a subtle undulating field of energy, sort of like waves in water, you know, or even ice. You know, if you think about how water condenses into ice, you know, ice feels very solid. It has a particular shape. You can measure it. But ice will melt back into water, and then you realize that ice is made of water, and eventually water will evaporate into vapor. So that's actually the kind of contemplation you want to do with your thoughts easier to do with thoughts than with perceptions. You know, our senses are so much in the business of making us believe that what we see, taste, smell, etc., is outside us, that it requires some more attentiveness. And I suggest if you want to work with your senses that you close your eyes, because the sense of sight is so overwhelming, and really, really feel your way into, for instance, the sounds that you're hearing as you listen to my voice, or as the connection between your, if you put your hand on your thigh, the connecting point between your hand and your thigh is a felt sensation, and the sensation itself is not concrete. It's a subtle experience, which you wouldn't realize is such a subtle experience if you weren't really focusing in on it. So that's how you do this contemplation. You actually focus on the in-the-moment phenomena of thought in the mind. Notice it. Notice the thought, not so much the content as the feeling of the thought. Notice that the thought is going to dissolve. And that will take you more and more into beginning to have a feeling for what the mind really is, for the fluidity, for the flowing quality of the mind, for the energetic quality of the mind. So this is a form of inquiry that is based on, you know, a kind of tactile sensation, felt sense, feeling into how a thought is experienced. So I'm just would suggest you try that and let me know how it's going, and I'll give you some, you know, give me some feedback on how that works. We'll find something that actually helps make this real for you. But I would suggest doing some of the homework contemplations, because that's pretty much the basic contemplations for discovering the subtle nature of mind. And thank you for that question.
Maybe this is along the lines. We had another question that said, this person didn't understand the process of the partner practice, awareness, and whole field awareness.
Okay, great. So again, thank you for that. Whole field awareness, well, this is how I like to do whole field awareness. Whole field awareness is, it describes what your experience is when you're actually allowing yourself to be aware of everything within your field of experience, which means that you actually are, if you pay attention, aware of what's going on behind you. You actually know what's in the room behind you, as well as what's in front of you. So if you kind of extend your attention with a sense that your attention can actually hold your body, the way I often do it is imagine myself sitting or standing behind my body so that I can see my back, which is completely counterintuitive. We don't really understand that that's possible, because, you know, we think that seeing means seeing with the eyes. But if you want to do that now, put your awareness behind your body and just be aware that your body is actually an object of your attention. And that's whole field awareness. And if you're doing whole field awareness with your partner, if you bring your awareness behind you and simultaneously have the sense of placing your awareness behind your partner, and this works even if you can't see your partner, because something in consciousness knows how to do this, and just have this sense of a field of presence, a field of awareness that is not not privileging the position of me inside my body, but is actually allowing itself to be wider than the body. That's what whole field awareness is. And at some point, you and your partner will click into experiencing each other inside a field that I'm calling awareness, and which is actually shared, even though your history, your way of thinking about things, you know, even your understanding about what we're talking about may be really different. But at the level of being aware, of being conscious, of being sentient, there's a completely unbreakable connection, which is, I think, how these satsangs can be so powerful. So that's what I mean by whole field awareness. And the trick in it is to get a sense of your awareness, your attention being behind the body, so that your body is contained in it, and then feel that you also can simultaneously extend that attention to hold your partner, your invisible partner who's, you know, on a telephone somewhere 500 or 1,000 or 3,000 miles away from you, but nonetheless, that connection of your awareness is unbroken and present, and so you begin to feel that the two of you are being held in the awareness, the attention that you share, because all sentient beings share this. And again, it's a practice that reveals itself as you do it. I hope that explanation helps you get into it. And if not, write another question and we'll examine it some more.
All right, we have one more person from Vermont. I just unmuted you. Had your hand raised.
Yes, hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me? Hi.
Hi.
Tina. Hi.
Hi.
So my question is sort of, it's not really very specific, but I was just, I've been using the Chris Wallace's Recognition Sutras as a sort of companion.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been really wondering about prana and how prana shakti is related to the chitti shakti. And it seems like, you know, there are practices like pranayama that invite this vitality into the body, but that the awareness of the chitti shakti awareness is just this field that we're always, and maybe I have this wrong, but it's a field that we're, that's always there if we just kind of pull back the veil and look at it. So how
yes,
are
well,
these things related?
Again, really good question. So what some of the tantric texts say that's quite interesting is that as chitti involves herself in the process of becoming the physical world, that one of the phases that she passes through is, you know, is the phase of prana. So prana is shakti, is chitti shakti, at a slightly denser level than mind, than awareness. And the quality of prana, of course, is energetic. Prana is also an expression of the air element. You know, this subtle element of air. In the five elements description of form related to sight, of sound relating to space, breath is related to air. So, and air is that the elements are slightly more, slightly denser than pure awareness. But prana is the well, it's the second most subtle of the elements. And the prana shakti, as you meditate with it, especially in this classical meditation that we were talking about earlier, where you follow the breath, you follow the inhalation to the end, to the place where it dissolves, you follow the exhalation to the place where it dissolves, and there at that space between the in-breath and the end of the in-breath and the start of the out-breath, or the end of the out-breath and the start of the in-breath, you start to be able to feel your way into the absolute subtlety that gives rise to prana. So it's the difference is really between the relative, how shall I say this, visibility or feelability of awareness and prana. Prana is more manifest. It's easier to feel it, you know, because it actually has this quality of touch to it. So you actually can feel the breath moving in your body. And and it's so pranayama practices are ways of actually making the bridge between your externalized, outgoing, you know, ordinary consciousness, attention, awareness, and the fully indrawn experience of being fully present with awareness, with chitti in her very subtle interior form. Prana is like a thread that you can grab hold of that will make the bridge between your exterior attention and your interior attention. And that's, you know, in terms of sadhana, that's one of the powers of pranayama practice. There's a lot of other yogic benefits that pranayama has, as you probably know. But in terms of the practice of self-liberation, the real secret of prana is not to control the breath, not to use the breath to put you into more powerful states, but to actually use the breath as, again, another very powerful breadcrumb trail that as you follow it, it will take you into your own interior and eventually into the state of stillness, where you begin to become aware of awareness, where the different ways of experiencing the subtle body begin to reveal themselves. So prana is a vehicle through which life is empowered, and it's also a vehicle through which life is able to trace itself back to its source. So does that make sense?
Does that
answer your question? I mean, obviously, this is a huge topic. You know, the subject of prana and pranayama and the relationship between prana and mind is one of the big subjects of yoga. So there's a lot we could say about it that we don't have time to say. The connection's very palpable. The connection between prana shakti and the subtler shakti of chitti.
I just wanted to do a quick little chime in about, you know, the discussion earlier about sort of the possibility of the patriarchal nature of having Shiva at the top of the tatva.
The pole, yeah.
And
yeah.
I finally got an opportunity to travel to South India last year, and it was so beautiful to see that Shiva was honored oftentimes as like a rock. Like there would just be this, and there would be, or maybe like an anthill or something, and it was like something would arise out of the earth, and
right.
They would sort of build a shrine around it, and it would be Shiva. And that
yes.
really helped me shift out of seeing Shiva as a man. I think that
yes.
put, like awareness isn't human, right? So
right.
To put Shiva as like a human man.
Right.
You know,
the anthropomorphic Shiva.
Yeah.
Right, right. And I just love that connection that Shiva could be a rock or an anthill. So I just
yes. And so can Shakti. You know, Shakti can be a hole in the earth.
Right.
I mean, obviously the gender symbolism is very obviously connected to the genital organs in men and women, which is, you know, which is why so many shrines to Shiva are phallic, you know, are lingams, and
mm-hmm.
And so many shrines to Shakti are holes, you know, are hollow places or valleys. So this understanding that's so prevalent in India of the you know, of how the land itself is carrying the symbology and actually the reality of divinity. It's, you know, that's part of the gift that India gives us. How great that you got to go there.
Mm, yeah. Thank
yeah.
you.
But yes, we the question of gender right now is really, really, it's really up for deep contemplation. So I'm happy that we're discussing it. Again, it's a big topic that is a lot to say about.
Sally,
so,
it's 6:06. I wasn't sure if we wanted to continue. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we should follow our promises and end on time. So,
okay.
Again, I thank you for just making this conversation so juicy. And, you know, if you guys would like to, you know, just open up the gender conversation at some point during one of these Q&As, we can definitely do that. You know, Shiva, Shakti, and men and women, and how we can really use this understanding to shift our understanding of gender roles. You know, it's a very powerful, as so many of you know, to start to see how the Shiva Shakti qualities in reality and the you know, the masculine feminine qualities in reality play themselves out at different levels of consciousness. So thank you so much for being here, and I'm just so great to be in this conversation, and it's deepening and will continue to deepen. And please, again, thank you so much for bringing your questions about the text and about the way I'm explaining things so that we can clarify them, which hopefully we are. And I so appreciate your practice and the deep, subtle intelligence that you guys bring to this satsang that we're having together. I'm really very moved and honored by who you all are. And so let's bring our hands together in Anjali Mudra. If anyone has a question that came up that didn't get asked or answered, feel free to write it into the listserv or privately to me if that works better for you. And we'll chant Om 3 times. Big inhalation. Thank you so much. Have a great evening and a great day tomorrow, and we'll be in touch as always on this subtle internet and on the virtual world of the fiber optic cables that connect us all over the world. Thank you so much. Thank you so much. And hello to Vivi and the others of you who are in Europe and at a very late or very early hour dialing into us perhaps from your beds. So very beautiful to be connected to so many continents. Good night. So much love.